Welcome to Always Hold On to Smallville. In this podcast, we talk about each and every episode of the Young Superman show that ran from 2001 to 2011 on the WB and the CW. I'm your host, Zach Moore, and for this episode, I'm again joined by Daniel Prue. What's up, Daniel?
Not too much. I'm excited to come back to Smallville. You know, I spend a lot of time talking other shows and stuff, and it's not something I get to revisit like very often, so it's always cool to come on here and talk some Smallville.
Always cool to come on Always Hold On to Smallville. You heard it here first, folks. Yeah, no, so Dan, last time you were on, you did the penultimate episode of season one, so it's been quite a while, man.
It has. I missed quite a bit because when I went to watch this episode, I didn't have any context and I had completely forgotten a lot of stuff. So it was actually really interesting and will be fun to talk about.
Yeah, so this is part two of the season two two-parter. First was Calling, this was Exodus. I like how Smallville kind of started to do a pattern. They didn't always stick to it, but like season two, season three, right? They close with a two-parter, they open with a two-parter. I feel like that allows a story to breathe a little more than if you try to cram everything just in, you know, the 45 minutes of one episode, right?
Yeah, totally.
So in the Smallville, the official companion, season two by Paul Simpson, available wherever books are sold, Al Goff had this to say about Exodus. I liked Exodus very much. At the beginning of the episode, Clark has everything he ever wanted, and by the end of it, he has nothing. Season 1 ended with the height of heroism, with Clark running into a tornado to save Lana. For Season 2, we wanted to see the nadir of that, or nadir. As you guys know, pronunciation is not my strong suit on this podcast. which is Clark running away. He gets on, quote, drugs, the Red Kryptonite, gets on his motorbike, and runs away from his problems. In the journey to become a superhero, these are the sorts of trials you're going to face. And was it what Jor-El was planning all along? So that's what Al Goff had to say. And then he goes on to say, quite honestly, we wanted to get rid of the spaceship. Once the props start talking, you've got to be careful. We wanted to blow it up and be done with it. We had the caves, so we still had a Kryptonian connection, but we played the ship. How many times are people going to go down into the storm cellar? We wanted to be rid of it, but we wanted to do it in a big way. You know, a couple thoughts there. I miss the spaceship. I wish they would have kept it around more. I kind of liked that they had that down there in the instead of the caves. You know, the caves are its own topic, right? So what are your thoughts on the spaceship and losing it so soon in the show?
I feel the same way, you know, basically without getting off into a little rabbit trail here. I would have preferred that they just kept the ship and lost the caves completely.
Yes. I think should've blown up the caves.
Yeah, I think that would have made way more sense. I did think it was a kind of a cool way to get rid of it, though, with the kryptonite key and all that. And obviously, big explosion, so that was fun. But yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing that they were attached to the caves, but not the ship, where at least the ship makes a lot more sense to have, like, a direct connection, you know, for Clark, so.
And I thought about it, and I guess they never rebuilt the storm cellar set. Like, I guess once they... I wonder if they converted it into something else. I'm sure, you know, along the way, I'll find some trivia. It's like, well, the storm cellar set space was converted into this because, you know, they're always building new sets on Smallville. But yeah, I guess, you know, I was so used to them, you know, going down there and having the ship under the tarp and all that stuff for so many years. It feels like, you know, we're closing this chapter. We're going on to a new chapter of the show. So, you know, there's a lot to talk about. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. Exodus.
Who are you?
I am Jor-El, your father.
I thought you died.
I am his memory. His will. I am to fulfill his promise and guide you all the days of your life. You are the last son of Krypton. When you traveled through the cosmos, you carried the hopes and dreams of your people. They now live through you, Kal-El. It is time.
Time for what?
Time to accept your destiny.
I don't know what you have in mind for me.
By the setting of the sun's soul, you will return to me. Your destiny will be fulfilled. Your thoughts are not a mystery to me, Kal-El. But these people have served their purpose. It is time to leave them. Let go of your past. I will guide you to your future.
No, I don't want your guidance! I want to create my own future!
You have no choice, Carlyle.
Exodus aired on May 20th, 2003. It was written by Alfred Goff and Miles Miller and directed by Greg Beeman. And you know what struck me about this episode starting out, Dan, is there's no previously on Smallville.
Yep.
Right? It just kind of starts and Clark's walking down into the storm cellar. And, you know, I didn't remember. Obviously, it's been a long time since I've seen these episodes. And I always just kind of assumed that there would be a previously on so-and-so. I mean, like, these days, like on Arrow and The Flash and Supergirl, right? It's always like every episode is previously on The Flash. And it shows you, like, all this stuff that's happened. So they do just kind of throw you into it, don't they?
Oh, yes. And since I hadn't watched the previous episode, I was like, oh, okay, we're doing something pretty serious here all of a sudden. And, you know, he gets down there and Zod starts yelling at him. Obviously not really Zod, but...
Kneel before Zod.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess maybe I should have watched the episode before. But I was like, you know what, I'll just try it and see how it is, how it stands on its own.
So how long had it been since you've seen Exodus?
Oh, my goodness. I rewatched the show about... 2-3 years ago.
And yeah, that's fresh enough. See, for nerds like us, it's fresh enough.
Yeah.
Because we retain stuff longer than your average viewer, I feel like, the genre fans like us, so.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But still, it was a little, you know, like I said, because you mentioned that I was on the show for the last season, and that was the last time I watched Smallville. So it was, you know, season one was kind of fresh in my brain, not this new stuff. So I was like, whoa, okay, we're just jumping right in. Okay.
Now, as you mentioned, Zod starts yelling at Clark. Now, this is Terrence Stamp, the voice of Jor-El, most famous for playing General Zod in the Christopher Reeve movie, Superman 1 and 2. And I felt like this was, like, brilliant casting. What about you?
Yeah, and obviously, especially with the direction that they went, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but this idea that maybe Jor-El isn't necessarily such a super awesome dude. And Terrence Stamp has a great villain voice. So, yeah, this is... It's a great nod to the 70s films, and it's a wonderful piece of casting.
Goff said about casting Terrence Stamp, "We got Terrence Stamp to play Jor-El because we wanted someone from the Superman mythos, and he was happy to do it." And Terrence Stamp, he sticks around for a long time. Now, we first heard him in Calling, the last episode, just very briefly, and then his credit was at the end of the episode. So this is the first time, like, when you come back from the opening credits, it's like, special guest star, Terrence Stamp is the voice of Jor-El. And if you had to guess, just throw out a guess. Dan, how many episodes do you think Terrence Stamp's voice was in?
Oh, boy. Over the whole course of this...
Over the whole 217, 218 episodes, what would you say?
I would venture a guess and say 30.
30, okay. If we're going by Price is Right rules, you would be wrong, because it was 23. But it feels like he's around more than that, right? But that's what's cool about recurring characters like this. You know, even on... Yay. We're Star Trek buddies, you know, talk about Star Trek, and we have these characters that show up every now and then, and then your head kind of fills in that they're in all these other episodes, right?
Oh yeah,
they're really not. But that's good universe building when you just assume that. Oh yeah, it's Jor-El. Yeah, he's around all the time. He usually shows up at season finales and season premieres. If you look at
the pattern. That makes sense. Yeah, because those are the big episodes.
Jor-El's talking. Something serious is going on. He starts out just. I don't know, it's kind of ominous the whole time. First of all, it's Terrence Stamp, so it's a Superman fan. Like, oh, it's Zod, right? And there was a lot of fan theories. Like, oh, maybe it's really Zod who took over the ship. It's like, no, guys. No, it's just a cool Superman connection in the real world. But he's telling Clark it's time to take over the planet. And the ship kind of does a lot of stuff we didn't know it was going to be able to do. Like, it's like a hologram. It turns into, like, the Earth. It blows up. It shows Clark, like, images of his parents and Lana. And it gives him a whole presentation down there, doesn't it?
Yeah, I kind of wish they didn't do so much with it, because it's like it transforms and then literally turns into nothing. It just turns into light. And I'm like, wait a minute. This is like a piece of technology. It's not magic. And why couldn't it just kind of project something for him to see? Like, that would be fine and seem reasonable. I don't know. I just felt like they were kind of going crazy with it for no real reason.
I mean, like, you got a limited budget here, guys. I mean, you don't need to blow it here, right?
Yeah, exactly. This scene can have a lot of impact with just, you know, something a little less flashy, I think.
Yeah, my favorite little moment in this scene is they do like a speed ramp, like pan around, like from the ship over to Clark. And I thought that was a nice little cool little moment there, but you don't see very much in that same style in Smallville. So I like that a lot. But basically the ship's telling, hey, by sundown tomorrow, you need to start your journey to rule the planet, which is, you know, they've been teasing this all season with these messages Clark has been getting. And so you were not a fan of this interpretation of, at the time, like, oh, maybe Jor-El wasn't the nice old scientist that we've seen in all the other interpretations of Superman, huh?
Yeah, it wasn't my favorite version. I don't know. I feel like they just did it to switch it up a bit. And I feel like they waffle on it too, like later on down the line. So it's I don't know. It's not, no, I don't like evil or mean Jor-El. I prefer nice guy Jor-El.
Well, I think, you know, if they had, and again, and I always talk about this, and we'll get into this when the time comes, when Superman Returns came around, they felt the need to kind of align Smallville with Superman Returns, like with the visuals, with the storytelling, with everything, really, with the Donnerverse movies and the Christopher Reeve movies. And so I think that's what kind of led to some contradictions. I feel like if they had just, like, stuck to the past, stayed the course with this interpretation of Jor-El, it might have been an interesting, just alternate, like, nature versus nurture story, basically. I mean, that's what Lex and Clark is all nature versus nurture, but then to have Clark come from a planet of, like, yeah, I conquered this planet, and for the Kents to be, like, the reason that, you know, he's the great superhero he is. I think that was an interesting angle. They just really didn't dive into it deep enough, and then, like you said, they kind of changed course at some point. But it was an interesting approach on us. But, I mean, that's what drives all the drama in this episode, right? If it was like, hey, Clark, I'm your father, go be awesome. You know, I've sent Earth my only son, right? All the very... very on-the-nose Jesus metaphors of the Christopher Reeve movies. So that would have been, like, there would be no conflict there. But he's basically telling him, hey, you have to, you know, go, you know, start your quest, whatever that means. It'd be interesting, like, there's so many interruptions over Smallville. Like, I don't know how many, like, variations of this scene happen in the show, but there's many of them, right? And it would have been interesting to see, like, if Clark had followed through, what would happen?
Yeah, he's so vague the whole time. He's just like, it's time to start your journey, and you never really know what he's saying. I actually kind of like if they did stay the course, I actually kind of like that idea that maybe Zod had taken over the ship or something like that and was kind of being Jor-El. That actually would make sense. I think you run into a problem. If you turn Jor-El bad into a villain, then you don't really incentivize Superman to, like, wear the crest or anything like that, or want any ties to Krypton, you know? So I think that connection is important for the Superman character. So it would be interesting. I don't know how they would deal with something like that.
That's an excellent point. I didn't really think about that, because he would never want to honor the Krypton's history. He wouldn't have the fortress. Like, it would really cut him off from that whole mythology. So that's a good point. We can talk about the crest later, which is something else that changes.
Oh, yes.
The cards of the show. So we go to opening credits, we cut back, and Clark's telling his parents, like, you know, what happened. Like, he says, it sounded like the ship was talking to me, but it was kind of in my head. So it's kind of like, they leave it all very vague. Like, maybe all that stuff was just in Clark's head, and the ship was just the ship. And this is where the Kryptonian technology, like, as you said, starts to turn into kind of magic. So it's like, yeah, you know, whatever. But, you know, he's at this point, he's being honest with his parents, right? And there's a theme in this episode about honesty, and it gets worse and worse as the episode progresses. If all these characters were just, like, sit down and, like, tell each other what was going on, I feel like all the drama in this episode probably could have been circumvented. Going back to Clark and Jor-El, it's like, hey, what exactly do you want me to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of, like, I don't care. He, like, cuts him off. He's like, I don't know what plans you have for me, but I'm going to create my own future. It's like, all right, man, just hear the guy out. I mean, he's your alien father. Come on.
You're totally right that if these people sat in a room and talked to each other for 5 minutes, all of this would be avoided.
So...
everything, all of this drama, but
yeah, and I feel like that's something that weakens this episode a bit, but we'll you know, as we continue to break these down, we'll go into it. But the Kents have their traditional, like, hey, Clark, no one decides your destiny but you. Lots of destiny talk in this episode, right? And Clark kind of makes his decision, like, well, Smallville's my home, everything I love is here. And it does kind of suck, because he's like, man, everything's finally working out in my life, why does this have to come up? And it feels like that in life sometimes, right? He's like, thanks, like, everything happens at once.
Yep.
It's just overwhelming. It's true. So I did identify with that aspect of the episode, because you want to think, okay, well, the bad stuff's happened over here, but now we settled that, now we got good stuff going on. But no, when life throws it at you, they usually throw it at you all in one big hit. But then we cut back to the Luther Mansion, and I cut back to, it's our first time seeing Lex this episode, but it's following up a plot from Calling, where there's a subplot where Helen's office had been broken into, and Clark's blood from fever had been stolen. It was a big mystery about who did it, and Lex is the one who did it. And again, at the end of that episode, it's the big reveal. He pulls it out of his secret compartment, and he, like, admires the blood. And here we are again. He's still standing there looking at it.
Where does he get this custom case? That, like, it's amazing that every time they have these little props and stuff, that they always have these things that they hold them in. I'm like, where did you even find that kind of a thing?
Yeah, it's like hermetically sealed. Like you see the ice coming out of it because it's you know blood and all that. But he's admiring it. You know, and just it's more for the audience than anything else. But I mean, as we come to learn through this conversation, he's made a decision. He's gonna come clean with Helen about what he had done. But he goes out into the hallway there at the mansion. He sees Lionel and Helen in the hallway, and Lionel has an envelope, and you can't really tell like where it came from or who's given what who. But Lex kind of interrupts their conversation and. And he's like, oh, well, what are you two doing here together? And Lionel basically says, oh, I'm just trying to give her a wedding present that she has rejected. And then he goes on his way. So interesting seeds to be sown there.
Yeah. Interesting is one way to put it.
You know, the character of Helen, right? I've been talking about this the whole time. This is a retrospective podcast, so spoilers, right? I feel like what they ended up doing with her kind of undercut everything and we'll everything. You know, I'll say that those thoughts at the very very end when it's kind of becomes almost obvious what might have happened there. But you know, they had, you know, Lex and Helen had kind of a, you know, blow up last night about lies and honesty and all this stuff. And Lex, although he hadn't told her that he stole the blood, she basically said, hey, you know, if we can't trust each other, then we can't get married. And things were kind of up in the air. So she's come back to talk to Lex, and he's like, look, I want to come clean. I want to break the cycle. I want to be my father. And he pulls out the blood and shows her that he's the one who stole it. And, you know, it's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see how it turns out for him, right? I mean, would you have done that? I mean, I don't see a positive there.
Well, I can see why he would do it, because he has been stuck in this cycle of deception for so long. He doesn't know what else to do. He's certainly never tried this before. You know, it's him essentially expressing some vulnerability for the first time in a lot of ways. And that's because that is something that a Luther wouldn't do. And so he's thinking, that's how I can stop. That's how I can get out of this. And
well, I like what he's like, I don't want to be the person who did this anymore. And I like what she says. She says, but you did do it, Lex. You committed a crime.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But of course we'll find out later, but she comes back. So it does work. You know, it is bold, but it actually works.
It does work. But then you question all these motives too, right? And it's like, there's one thing to like be all vague about it and then like, oh, it all makes sense. But then they're all vague about all this stuff. And then it still doesn't make sense. But anyway, okay. So Helen and Lex, do you like them, their like relationship together? I mean, you think that's a good thing? I mean, I was kind of on the fence about it, but rewatching it, I did like them as a couple.
I like the character of Helen a lot, especially obviously earlier on when things aren't so weird. And then them together is interesting. She seems to be like his intellectual equivalent, so I really like their relationship in that aspect. And obviously, she brought out some good in him here, because he is actually admitting to this crime and to breaking her trust. So she definitely had a positive influence on him. But of course, like you mentioned, now we have to ask ourselves, well, what is her motivation doing this? Which, again, I think sullies the entire thing, but yeah, frustrating.
Well, she asked Lex, what did you think you would get by this anyway? And he said, I thought it would give me the answers I was looking for. She's like, well, all it did was in this relationship. It's like, oh, all right, well, there we go. Now it's
drama.
All finished off. There's lots of drama in this episode.
Oh,
even,
so much
even
drama.
From the non-high schoolers. So I guess, you know, Lex, he didn't know whose blood it was. He tells Helen he didn't have an analyze. So now it's nothing. Like, he has no extra knowledge. So don't worry, everyone. He doesn't know Clark's secret. Everything is safe. He's obsessed with the meteor shower. He's obsessed with Clark. There's a lot of intersect there. He never knew it was Clark's blood, though. So at least there's that. We cut to Clark and Lana. They're out just chilling by a tree with horses, you know, because that's what they do in their spare time. So Lana does in
doing
her spare
nothing.
Time. Yeah.
There's no like picnic or anything. It's just like they're just there and canoodling. Which
just
is fine,
sitting there with a Take Me Away by Lifehouse, right? You got to, again, you have to love the late, you know, the mid-2000s, early 2000s soundtrack of this show.
Oh, I love it. It brings me back so much when I hear these songs over and over again. I'm like, oh my God, I haven't heard this, you know, in years. It's so fun.
Right. And, you know, Lifehouse, there was kind of the love theme of the first season with like everything. It was in the pilot. It was in the finale. So they're going back to the van, if not the same song. Because this is, I mean, it starts out as a nice little moment for them. And by the way, is it just me? And I've said this before. They kiss kind of, like, they kiss very oddly, do they not?
It kind of looked like they were trying to eat each other. I'm not sure what was going on there. It was, it was a very aggressive kiss. I'll say that, it seemed.
Oh, boy, these guys.
Teenage hormones, I guess, right?
Yeah.
That's, maybe that's what it is.
Well, we'll chalk it up for that because, you know, these are 16-year-olds, let's not forget, during all these actions.
16-year-olds, played by 35-year-olds. Yeah, but that's
being generous, you know, 16. It's like, okay, if I round up, if I had like an August birthday, you know, yep. Something like that. But they're sophomores in high school. Clark does say something cute. He's like, does this mean you're officially my date to Lux's wedding? He's like, oh, that's a cute line, Clark. But she's like, well, not until we tell Chloe we're dating. He's like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess we should, because... Yeah, that's another angle to this drama, because, you know, at the end of the last episode, Lionel had offered Chloe this job at the Daily Planet. She was excited about it, but then he wanted her to investigate Clark, so she was like, she said, screw you, I'm not going to do that, he's my friend, and then Lionel's like, well, I wonder if Clark would give up his dream out of loyalty to you, Miss Sullivan, and, you know, he kind of lets that simmer there, and throughout the course of this episode, we see that, well, Chloe comes to discover that he would not saw Clark and Lana making out at the end of the last episode, so that's where she's at, so she already knows they're together, right, but because Clark and Lana have made this decision that, you know, like, Clark's going to be the one to tell Chloe that they're together, you know, because they just made a promise they're going to be honest with each other no matter what, right? That creates more drama. That's just what this episode...
Lots of drama.
That's what this episode needed. We cut to commercial, we cut back, and we're at the Luther Mansion, and Clark is reading a newspaper article that Lionel has moved back into the Kawachi Caves. He's taken it over. He's finally wrestled custodianship of the caves from Lex, and he's going to get to work down there to investigate what's going on. But their conversation quickly turns to something else because Clark tells Lex, hey, I'm here to get fitted for the best man suit. Where's this guy? And Lex is like, well, there's not going to be a wedding, Clark. So we don't need that anymore. And these early seasons of Clark and Lex when they're like just talking about relationships and stuff and just nothing's about like him or secrets. Or I mean, it is about secrets and lives from Lex's point of view, but it's not about Clark for a change. So I find these scenes refreshing. It just reminds you that these guys were actually friends back in the day, right?
Yep, friends. Yeah, it's which you don't get that too much of, so it is nice to see it. Yeah, but obviously Clark is surprised to learn that there's not going to be a wedding.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Lex says, he even says himself, he's like, I did something very unluther like I came clean to Helen, I was dishonest with her, I betrayed her trust, and you know, he didn't know what to expect. I mean he was expecting the typical Hollywood, like, oh, I was honest with you, everything, all is well, you know, and that you know, it will happen, but it hasn't happened quite yet. And then we cut to the caves because now that Clark knows that Lionel is down there, he's gone down to investigate. I did like how earlier Lex said, he's really tight in security, I doubt even you could slip past, because Clark's had a tendency to get down there. So he's down there, and you know, John and Glover, and you know, he's back in full force now. This is I said this pretty much every episode now, but he's peak Lionel at the end of season 2 and season 3. He's the big bad of Smallville, and excellent in every scene. And so Clark goes down there, he's snooping around this cave, and then all the lights turn on, and Lionel comes around the corner, he's like, I'm gonna have to put a stop to these unauthorized visits. So
he's so good at being menacing, so good. So this scene was great. This was probably my favorite scene of the episode, just because, you know, and it also seems a little unfair. I mean, granted, he is super bad, but like, Lionel is picking on this, like we just mentioned, 16-year-old sophomore, and like manipulating and doing all this stuff and trying to intimidate him and everything. And it's like, man, I mean, he is a creep, he is the bad guy, but it's like, he is just awful, but he's great at it. So it's like, you just get angry at him. And I love John Glover. He's great.
Oh yeah. He is. Him and Michael Rosenbaum make this show.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just, everything else was garbage. I mean, and sometimes it is. I love this show.
You're not wrong.
Yep. Sometimes it is. They would be the saving grace of the show. And, Lionel, you know, he goes on his, you know, goes on this villainous monologue to Clark about how, you know, that he's going to unlock the secrets behind these walls, and because he had told Clark about the key that he used to have that got stolen from his office, and but now he's going to put a key in a slot in the wall, which is it is just funny that, you know, this key, it fits the spaceship, it fits this slot in the wall, it fits another slot in another room we come to find later. You know, yep. So there's so many slots.
I guess it's like a key to the city kind of a thing, like a universal key.
It's a Kryptonian skeleton key.
Yeah, skeleton key. Thank you.
There is some good continuity here between the last episode because, you know, Dr. Walden had gotten downloaded with, you know, something. Some say Brainiac, some say the Eradicator. You know, it's never, they never spell it out this early in the show because that's way too inside baseball as far as comics go. But he was ranting and raving in the last episode how, you know, Clark is the last son, he's going to rule us all, and both Lex and Lionel heard that, and Lex wrote it off as just Walden being crazy because he was disturbed. But Lionel heard it and you know, took it a little more to heart, and that he's been interested in Clark for quite some time, so that just adds more fuel to that fire. And but Clark's like, hey, didn't you see what happened to Dr. Walden? Doing this kind of stuff is dangerous. But Lionel, he's using every precaution. That's the only reason I can justify with him not just putting the key in the slot like right now. Because
I was thinking that too.
He's got all these machines, and he's like, I'm gonna unlock the secrets, I can't wait. But they just keep waiting and waiting and waiting, and I was like, that's stupid plot reasons. But because I just saw what happened to the last guy that presumably put a key in the slot, I can understand his hesitancy.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Although he does say Luther never got anywhere by playing it safe, so it's like, well, then why don't you just go do it right now, man?
just do it. What are you afraid of, man?
Obviously, they can't for plot reasons, it was just funny that to hear that line and to think, okay, well, you have the key and presumably have had it for at least a little while. What are you waiting for?
Yeah, and then just another moment about this scene. Clark's telling him, like, well, I thought you lost your key. He's like, I did. But before it was stolen, I had it analyzed. And, you know, it's like nothing on this earth. You know what it's made out of? And then he, like, leans into Clark and almost, like, he looks around like it's a big secret and whispers to him. He's like, the meteor rocks found here in Smallville. it's such a bizarre acting choice, but that's what makes John Glover so good as his character. So he's like, I fashioned my own key, and he opens it up, and what I can only assume is a lead box, right? Because Clark had not detected kryptonite. I guess lucky for him, everybody makes things out of lead. But he's made a kryptonite key because, you know, he had the scan of the disc that he says, and then we had Dr. Walden's hand from the last episode Lionel had sent to him. So with all these pieces, he's been able to make his own key out of the same material, which is pretty smart. You want to make it out of the same material the original was, so it's basically a duplicate copy. It just made out of kryptonite. So that ties into why he was refining kryptonite. I mean, he was doing it for many reasons, but that's definitely one of the reasons. And Lionel, it's one of these classic, like, Lionel kind of notices that Clark's sick from the kryptonite, but you wonder if that's ever going to come into play, but it never.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Yeah. What I was a little not confused, but curious about was if they analyzed the metal of the disc and then said the most similar thing, I guess is probably what they did, would be kryptonite. As I wonder how close kryptonite and Kryptonian metal are, because obviously they're two different materials. I'm just curious. I was just curious how they, if they're both alien and they're different, I wonder how they made that connection.
It's like in Superman 3 where they can't figure out, like, the missing there's like a certain percentage of kryptonite because they're trying to make kryptonite with that supercomputer that Richard Pryor makes, right? And then he puts tar in as the missing ingredient, and that's why it doesn't work right, and it turns Superman into an ass. So maybe that's the case here.
Superman 3, okay.
Superman, I gotta say, man, the most rewatchable of all those movies very well might be Superman 3. It's very enjoyable. Ugh. I'm just, you know, I'm so played out, small tangent here, I'm kind of played out on Superman 2 with all the, you know, the different versions, right? Like this version, the Lester version, the Donner version, right? Inside baseball here, guys. Superman fans know what I'm talking about. But it's like, I'm just so, like, exhausted with all that about which one's better, you know? Superman the movie's a classic for sure. But Superman 3, like, if you just want to have a fun afternoon watching a Superman adventure, it's pretty good, man. Gotta say, Christopher Reeve's great in it, and Ed O'Toole. Martha Kent herself was in his Lana Lang.
That's right.
So if you haven't revisited Superman 3 in a while, you know, just approach it with the right mindset. You might enjoy it. It's pretty fun. But back to originally scheduled Smallville.
You might enjoy it. You might enjoy it.
You might maybe have a beverage or two, maybe with some friends, make fun of it, MST3K it.
There you go. That will definitely be a good time, for sure.
So we cut to Chloe's house, because let's not forget, Chloe and Lana are roommates now. Or housemates.
Oh yes, I've forgotten that whole element of Smallville. I'm like, oh yeah, they lived together for a little while.
There are these odd things in season two that you forget, like Martha's pregnant, right?
Yes, like I completely forgotten about
a lot of roommates. Yeah. You know, oh, Lex is getting married. Like, if it's just out of context, you're like, whoa, what happened to my show? But Lana's looking for what she's gonna wear at the wedding, and Chloe's like, oh, I'm sure you'll render Clark speechless, and she's like, oh yeah, where we're going? Yeah, we're going together as friends. Has Clark talked to you yet? Chloe's like, nope. She's like, well, he was going to talk to you. Like, look, I understand, Lana, that Clark said, let me talk to her, right? But you know what? Just talk to her now.
Yeah. And don't lie to her.
Don't lie to her face.
You just did, yeah.
You're going to push over to the dark side, and she's going to make some choices that she's going to regret later on. But, oh, man. So,
foreshadowing.
I know, right? This, and I don't know. Lana and Chloe being roommates, it's more shrinking the universe of Smallville. I never really liked it. I kind of liked in the beginning of the show where, like, Chloe had her world and Lana had her world and Clark was, like, their intersection, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, just making – it shrinks the universe when, like, there's no other – there's four characters, five characters.
Yeah, there's – it's like, you know people, you know, friends of friends that you just know because you have a mutual friend. And you don't instantly become best friends and move in with them because – there are other people in your life that you're more concerned about. So I totally agree with you. I wish that's kind of stuff does feel too convenient and easy to make this kind of stuff happen.
Cut to the Kent farm, and Clark is watching the sun go down because Jor-El's warning had been like, by the setting of your star soul or whatever, you'll return to me. So Clark's all worried about, he's intently watching the sunset as if, like, there's some kind of, like, sensor in the ship. It's like, okay, the sun's down. Now I'm gonna turn on. I mean, who knows? The thing's magic at this point.
Just that one part, though, when he was just, like, looking at the sunset, I was thinking, because I'm like, yeah, he was, like, really intently watching the sun go down. I'm like, I wonder if he has, like, some sort of sensation when he's in direct sunlight. Like, it feels really good for him, so he just kind of just sits up there all the time and, you know.
Well, that's true, because, you know,
soaks up the energy.
His powers come from the sun, so. Yeah. There is something to be said about the connection between the Krypton and all that stuff. So, but Jonathan has come up there and kind of watched the sunset together, and they're like, okay, hey, sunset, we're all good. We're fine. Nothing to worry about, right? And then as soon as he walks off, Jor-El's like, it is time, Kal-El, come to me. And that's what makes you think of Zod. Like, even the things that he says, you know, because yep. In Superman 2, he's like, come to me, son of Jor-El. So it's the same kind of terminology. So, you know, Clark just goes down to the cell. What if he didn't go down there? What if he just ignored the voice, right?
We don't know. They never tried anything different. He just, okay, I'll do it. Here I come.
People criticize Clark for making a lot of bad decisions, and it's like, yeah, you know, whatever. But this is like, he messed up big time in this episode. He makes a series of unfortunate choices. So he goes down there, and the ship's like, you will obey me, Kal-El. He's like, you're not my father. You can't control me. And then the ship, you know, just does one of these energy pulses. And this is actually a pretty cool stunt here where Clark gets pinned up to the ceiling of the storm cellar. Shirts gets ripped open, and Jor-El burns the Kryptonian 8 into his chest as he says, this is the mark of your ancestors, right? So that implies it's the House of El, it's their crest or whatever, which is cool, which in the comic books was the case at the time. And I liked that. And that's, and again, up until Superman Returns comes along and retcons everything, this was the Superman symbol from Krypton, you know? And hey, to your point, early, Dan, it's like, if Jor-El really was, like, this conquering villain, then he would never wear this. So that's a good point there. I hadn't thought about that. I thought it'd be just such a cool twist, at least for this interpretation, but you make a valid point to not go that way. But he burns this 8 into his chest, and we all know, oh, it's like almost like the Superman symbol. Cool. And I don't really know what the point of this was.
I don't either. I was thinking of that, too, and I'm like, why? I mean, is this, I don't know, maybe it's like a ritual. I don't know. I think they were just going for, it looks cool. And, you know, maybe it's like a painful reminder to obey his father, I guess. I'm not really sure. But he said it didn't hurt, so.
Yeah, and then in season 3, you know, it's kind of, when he wears the Red Kryptonite too long, it like burns his chest. So it's like, is this some sort of sense of control? Again, it's all very vague. It's cool. You look at it and you instantly think Superman because it's the Pentagon on his chest with the 8 almost S in there. But I like that. I liked how, and then gosh, I can't think of, you know, the Superman symbol anymore without thinking, like, on my world it means hope, you know.
Yes. Yep. I don't know. I actually don't know which version I like better, that he adjusts it so that it's an S or that it just is an alien character that looks like an S.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where I'm glad there's so many versions, because it's like there's no right or wrong way about it. I think I like how when it's an 8, but then he makes it an S because that's him making it his own. Because he's not 100% Krypton, but he's not 100% Earth. It's sure, a nice, like, yeah, middle ground. You know, because he had, earlier in Smallville, he had, this is one off that I think the entire show forgot about, but in Shop Class, he, like, made an S, and it was the Superman S, like, straight up. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. So if he kind of customized it, it shows a little more agency on his part than, like, oh, yeah, Jor-El just gave me this suit.
It's true. I'm just thinking of, like, when he goes and meets different species and, you know, it's just a shortcut way.
You're from the House of El. You're the,
yeah,
the
exactly. Yeah,
right, exactly.
I mean, I guess you could easily get around that, but I'm not sure. There's positives and benefits and negatives to both sides of it. So
So we cut to commercial, we come back. Clark is looking at Lana's old kryptonite necklace that had been neutralized back in Visage. I don't know if you recall, you know, Lana's kryptonite necklace. He got tied up throwing the storm cellar with it by a villain, and the ship turned on and neutralized it. And at the time, like, oh, this is really cool. Like, the ship has some kind of, you know, protection against kryptonite. You know, for Clark, you would assume that, you know, maybe they anticipate. Well, actually, it's established later in Smallville that, it's established this season in Skinwalker that kryptonite existed before Smallville existed, which is incorrect, but whatever. That should not be the case. But you assume the ship had some kind of programming that neutralized the kryptonite around it to protect baby Clark, you think, right?
Yeah. I wonder, though. I mean, how did... Kryptonite is only lethal once it becomes exposed to a yellow sun, right?
You would think so.
I mean, supposedly? Because obviously they were sitting on it on their planet with no problem for a long, long time. I'm just wondering how they had the foresight to kind of prepare for that. But I mean, it's a smart ship. It could just figure it out.
Magic. It can do anything. We established that. But yeah, I always thought, like the catalyst of the planet exploding is what created the kryptonite with, like, infused it with the radiation. I don't know. Like, I need to go read, like, The Science of Superman. I know that's a book. Maybe that can explain kryptonite to us. But all that to say that it's been established that the ship neutralizes kryptonite. So we see that, you know, that's a good bit of continuity there. Clark's looking at the necklace and it's on his mind. Then his parents come out and they're, you know, getting ready for Lex's wedding, because the big day's today. Lex had told Clark that he's not telling anyone that the wedding has been called off because he wants to live in that fantasy for a while long. He wants to have everybody go through all the trouble of getting together, going to the church, you know. I'm sure at some point, at some level, he's hoping, like, he's going to have his Hollywood ending where Helen's going to come back and, you know, forgive him, which she kind of does.
He paid for all that food and stuff, so he's just going to use it, I guess.
Don't open the caviar. You know, Goff and Miller wrote Spider-Man 2. Did you know that?
I did know that. I'd forgotten that, but yes, I did. Wow, that's a flashback. Yeah.
I know. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I also discovered they wrote, because I've been with the new Mummy movie that's come out recently. I've been interested in revisiting the old Mummy movies, you know, the Brendan Fraser series, and they wrote Curse of the Dragon Emperor. So
wasn't that the terrible one?
That was the third one, which I've never seen. But I watched the trailer. I was like, oh.
Yeah, well, the Mummy and The Mummy Returns are great movies.
Well, The Mummy is really a great movie. The Mummy Returns I haven't seen in years, but I went ahead and I bought the 4-pack on Blu-ray, because you get 4 movies for like $20. I'm like, it's like $5 a movie. I'll do that, because I love the first Brendan Fraser Mummy. It's like Indiana Jones for modern audiences, right?
It's awesome. So much fun.
The Mummy Returns, all I remember is the horrible, horrible CGI, The Rock.
Yeah, that's terrible. But the rest of the movie is still fun, like the first one.
Right. So I look forward to revisiting it. And then the Scorpion King came with it, which I've never seen. So I'm like, okay, I'll check that out. Because who doesn't love The Rock?
I've heard it's actually pretty good. I've never seen it, though.
All right. Well, we'll always hold on to The Mummy.
Yeah.
But no, I've never seen the third one. Because you know what I hate more than anything, Dan, is recasting. You know, recasting. And Rachel Weisz did not return for The Mummy 3. And they recast her with Maria Bello, which, sure, I guess, but just write her out. And so I was like, why didn't they just write the character out? Apparently they were holding out, because I've been researching all this stuff, because my fandom for those movies have been reinvigorated. But apparently they were holding out for Rachel Weisz to sign on, and she waited so long. They waited too long and she didn't sign on. Like, oh crap, we don't have time to rewrite the script. Let's just gonna have to recast her. So that kind of turned me off to The Mummy 3.
Yeah, but, I was bummed about that too.
So you win some, you lose some when it comes to movies, when it comes to Goff and Miller. But anyway, all that to say,
apparently
the Kents are here. They're going off to Lex's wedding. And Jonathan's like, no voice. And Clark's like, nope, no voice. I'm going to lie to my parents and act like everything's cool. And from this point forward, every interaction Clark has with somebody is like so like doom and gloom. Like, he's like, hey, mom, you look beautiful today. Like, as if he's never going to see them again. Right. Because he doesn't know what's going to happen. Because, you know, he knows he's going to have to get. Well, we know this plan soon. But we know the wheels that are turning here for him. But so that's the last time the Kents see each other before the incident at the end of the episode. So then we cut to Luther Mansion. Clark. Lex is looking at his wedding rings, just sulking in his own sorrow, I guess.
And then womp, womp. Helen, very sad.
Helen walks in and she's like, I am so mad at you. So it's like, that's an interesting way to reintroduce.
But I'm
going to
marry you anyway.
Yeah. And again, in a vacuum, you're like, oh, this is good. Look at Lex and Helen. And she's like, I realize that even though, you know, you upset me that I love you and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, good for them. Good for you two kids, you know? But again, it's all, you look at it all and with a grain of salt, knowing what you know. And it's so hard to talk about Helen in retrospect, because you still don't, it's not like some big revelation. It's not like we understand everything and we can, like, look back on this and say, oh, Well, this is why, obviously, she had to come back because that was all part of the plan to, you know, whatever the plan was.
Yeah.
With Lex.
Yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating. Yeah. It's one of those plot lines that I'm like, why did you have to do that? You know, why did you have to make it that way?
Their initial plan was to kill her off at the end of season two, which
that
makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because like, oh, okay, well, it's closed, right? And then you can take everything she said at face value. But anyway, I feel like whenever Helen comes up, you have to go on these tangents because it's like, I don't know how else to address it. But hey, wedding's back on. So,
woohoo.
See, Lex paid off, man. You just wait for a Hollywood ending. It's going to happen.
So real quick, what I was concerned about was if Clark actually showed up. We know he doesn't actually show up to the wedding, but if he did, he never got fitted for his tux. So would he have come in like with a really awkward length coat or something? I was a little concerned about that.
You know, when it comes to tuxedos, I'm gonna have a confession here. Unlike all the characters in this, I'm gonna be like Lex. I'm gonna confess something. When I was in band in high school, they gave us tuxedos. You know, for you know performances and stuff. You know, all school issued tuxedos. And, you know, they would keep them at school and you have to change and all that because it's school property, right? But I brought mine home because I'm like, this is stupid. I'm not going to come to school and change every time. You know, I'm a band, you know. So I just took it home and then I wore it to prom, you know, wore the fancy clothes to prom. But then I just never gave it back because I thought.
You stole it.
I might need a tuxedo at some point, you know. So I just kept it. And nobody said anything. So, I mean, that doesn't make it right. But like, hey, Clark made some mistakes in this episode. I made some mistakes, but I'm pulling a Lex. I'm trying to be honest here, guys. So there it is.
Well, I got to let you know that I'm really mad at you, but I'm still going to do this podcast.
Thanks, Daniel. Yep. Very good. Very good. So then we cut to the Storm Cellar, and Pete and Clark are talking about the brand that Clark has on his chest, and Clark has a plan to destroy the spaceship. Because he theorizes to Pete that perhaps the ship was not protecting Clark, it was protecting itself when it neutralized that piece of kryptonite in Lana's necklace, which is kind of a dumb theory, and I have a huge problem with this entire plot line. I get why radiation for Krypton would affect biological things, like people.
Yeah.
It's not going to affect technology. I mean, that's stupid, right?
Although, when he puts it in the ship, it like seems to like ultra-rust real quick, so I don't know, maybe that's why?
I get it. Like, that's the decision they took with Smallville.
Right.
But I feel like that doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, whatever. I mean, it's established. They're establishing it, I guess.
The rules of this universe. Yeah.
Yeah. It's. I could see why that would make sense. I mean, I know it makes way more sense that it would hurt a biological creature first or quicker. But like I said, maybe it just causes it to rust, even just in proximity. I don't know.
Well, to quote Pete, this is whacked. Okay.
He's right. He's not wrong.
Clark's plan is to put a kryptonite key in the ship and blow it up. Pete's like, man, Clark, you don't know what this could do. This could kill you. Besides, where are we going to get a kryptonite key? Which is just, whenever they mention kryptonite key, I just find it so absurd. I don't know why. That's one of those quotables that certain lines of dialogue stick with you. But then they have this dramatic music and this look between the two of them, Clark and Pete. And then we cut to the caves, okay, where Lionel's people are doing his thing, and he's like, oh, 10 more minutes. Like, they're waiting. I don't know what they're waiting for. Like, they're waiting for this this robotic arm to put the key in the slot to see what happens, I guess. But again, hey, Luther's never gotten anywhere by playing it safe, right? But
exactly. I like this scene a lot. It also is entirely pointless, I think, because Clark doesn't really need Pete to be a distraction, right? He could have literally just done the same thing without Pete.
Well, you know, maybe so. I will say that Lionel, as we've seen, he's carrying it around with him at all times, so they wanted to make sure that Lionel put the key down somewhere, because, like, if Clark super sped by and, like, pried it out of Lionel's hands, it'd be a little more obvious. I mean, I see your point. Now that you mention it, I see your point. How do they know Lionel was going to go set it down somewhere that Clark could super speed in and get it? I get it. But this is a great scene, though.
Oh, my goodness. It's so good to see Pete, of all people, give Lionel his comeuppance, you know? It's so mad at the end. It's great.
Right?
I loved it.
Is this not... This is arguably one of Pete's best episodes, and this might be his best scene in the show, really.
It probably is. I really, really liked it. You know?
Because he comes in there, and he's, you know, because it's established at the end of the Luthers bought the Ross Green Corn Factory, and that's why Pete doesn't like the Luthers, and Pete doesn't like Lex, and Pete doesn't like Lionel. So he comes in there, and he's like, hey, I'm Ross from Ross Cream Corn. And Lionel's like, oh, I remember you. I believe I overpaid for that ramshackle old factory. So he's already, like, condescending to him. And the security guards grab him. He's like, hey, let me go. You know you hate him. And Lionel's like, yes, I value their hatred. You know, people are at their weakest when they're angry. And that's a great, Like, he totally, that's a complete Luther mentality. I like that a lot. And then Pete turns it back around on him, because he's like, search him, where is it? And he like raises his hand to hit him, because he's like really angry. Like, Lionel, like, you've never seen Lionel this angry before. And Pete's like, careful, Mr. Luther, wouldn't want to look weak. And like, oh, look at you, Pete. Best in Lionel, yeah. Luther in a mind game there. So this is probably his best scene, but you've made it not as good enough, because you just explained how pointless it was, Dan. So thank you for that.
It was kind of pointless, but it was awesome. You cheer for Pete on the inside, because yeah, he doesn't get a lot of wins.
Mm-hmm. And Lionel even recognizes, he's like, oh, okay, kid. Nice, well played, mm-hmm. kid. Let me cut to the church, and Lex is waiting for Helen. At this point, the Kints have arrived, and the Kints are standing in for Lex's parents, because him and Lionel are at odds, and Lex's mother has passed away. So Jonathan gives Lex a compass, because it's a Kent family tradition. Like, oh, my father gave me this, and I'm going to give it to you. And it's like, so does Clark not get this now? Or
so he said giving a compass is a Kent family tradition. I assume that maybe that's just a compass, and maybe he'll give Clark, his plan is to give Clark his compass. So that was kind of, because I thought the same thing, but I'm like, the way it's worded, he goes, a compass. And he goes, it's a Kent family tradition to give a compass away so that you don't lose your way walking down the aisle. And he never said it was like, he just said that his father gave him one and now he's giving him one, but he didn't say at any time that it was the same one. Is this also like, there's only a very, very tiny slice of Smallville where Jonathan and Lex are on good terms. And it's always neat to see, because Lex is obviously super, super proud and happy that, you know, because he's always looks up to Jonathan as kind of a potential father figure, you know, somebody who's actually a real dad, unlike Lionel. And it only happens for a little bit, but you can tell it's played very well, because he seems very, very happy that this is happening.
Right. I mean, he idolizes Clark's life. I mean, he wants to be part of the Kent family, and this is like, this is as close as he's going to get, you know.
Yep.
And it's always two steps forward and one step back with him too. And you know, as Clark's relationship with Lex deteriorates, the Kent's relationship with Lex deteriorates as well. So that's one of those other tragedies. You know, it's sad to see over the course of the show.
It also, I'm just thinking of it now, but I just realized that yes, Clark's life falls apart in this episode, but so does Lex's. And I didn't even think of that connection, that the both of them at the end of this are kind of screwed.
Yeah, I like those parallels between their journeys together. That's very true. And right at the cusp of them having everything they always wanted. You know, Lex exactly. wanted to live happily ever after. He's part of the Kent family. He's got a wife. You know, he feels complete. And nope, nope. So then we cut to the barn, and we get Weapon by Matthew Goods playing. It's a nice little song. There's lots of great music in these episodes. It's very early. It's very nostalgic and early 2000s music. But Lana is up there. She's all dressed up, ready to go to the wedding, and she's like, why aren't you dressed? It's a cute little thing. But this scene does get a little soap opera, though, I will say.
Yep.
The actual lyrics, I mentioned the song because the lyrics of the song kind of play into the situation as well if you listen to it.
It's not subtle.
Yeah, it's Smallville ever that subtle? But
no, especially not with their music. No.
You know, we see, to answer your question, Dan, we see Lana hand Clark some kind of tuxedo of some kind. So I don't know where this came from, but he's got something to wear. He tells her some like heavy stuff. You know, like he's like, I have something important to do, and I'm doing it for us. And it's like, okay, whenever you hear that, it's like, yeah, that's uncomfortable territory. Now, she does have a reference back to Whitney. She's like, last time a guy told me that, he ran off to join the Marines or whatever. It's just something along those lines. And it's true. It's a nice callback to the season one finale where Whitney told Lana that. But, you know, she trusts him that, you know, he's got something important to do, and they have another one of their really awkward-looking kisses.
Yep. Really uncomfortable, man. It's just, I don't know what it is. Too much mouth? I don't, it's weird. I don't know.
It's like, do not learn how to kiss from watching these two guys.
People no. Okay. Oh, God, no. Matt looks uncomfortable.
Oh, man. Then he tells her, hey, Lana, I just wanted to remember this moment. And it's like, okay, man, now you're making it super creepy. Like,
again, yeah.
Like these last moments with all these important people in his life. But then she walks off, and she's like, okay, well, that was kind of weird, but, you know, Clark said he'd meet me at the wedding, so I'm going to go off to the wedding. And we see, you know, this tracking shot of her, like, walking off from Clark's point of view, and you're like, yep, that's it there. But then, you know, Clark, he has the kryptonite key that he's stolen from Lionel here, and so, again, must be in a lead box.
Yep. And at this point, I'm just like, why isn't he just super speeding into the cellar to put it on there? Because he keeps getting interrupted.
Mm-hmm. He gets interrupted by into these people. He has to say goodbye to every single character before he goes. We cut back to the church, and Lex is getting a little angsty because he tells the kids, like, Helen circled the church 5 times. Like, dang. Like, but then Lana comes in because Martha's like, I don't know where he is. He was going to come with Lana. Lana comes in, and Lana's like, oh, okay. Well, hey, Lana, where's Clark? She's like, well, he said he had something important to do. And the kids kind of share a look, and they're like, okay, we got to go. Lex is like, oh, no, we can wait. He's like, no, go ahead. Have your wedding. And to me, this you know, we're always joking about this on the show, like Lex's unhealthy obsession with Clark. He's like, oh, no, we'll wait on the wedding. We want to make sure Clark's here.
Yeah.
Just let this happen, Lex. So I feel bad for Lex here because he doesn't know what's going on. You know, and not only now Clark's not there, his surrogate parents are leaving now. So, like, it's slowly getting chipped away from his dream day as well.
And Lana's in the front seat. Crying, so
yeah, she's like, oh, Helen and Lex, but where's Clark? You know,
it's not going well, that's for sure.
So then we cut to the Kent farm, and finally, Clark is finally trying to put this thing in the ship because you know, Jor-El told him by the zenith of this, your star soul, you will begin your quest, or whatever. So it was like the night before, now it's like noon the next day. He's kind of delaying the stuff, he's giving Clark a chance, you know. So, you know, don't say Jor-El was a heartless AI, you know, he's giving Clark more opportunity to come to his senses.
What if Clark just kept procrastinating and, you know, every day it was by noon of the next day. I really mean it this time, Clark.
By the winter solstice, you will obey me. But we see, you know, a little insert shot of Clark looking at his watch because he's like, time is of the essence. It's like 10 till noon, right? But of course, Chloe drives up. He's like, Clark's like, oh, God, I forgot to tell Chloe. I got to deal with this, you know. But Chloe says, hey, Clark, what's up? You know, I heard Lana said you were looking for me. He's like, okay, look, yeah, I'll find you. I got something really important I got to do. And he literally shoves her back into her car. It's like, man, Clark, that's pretty aggressive, I thought.
I also want to point out, too, like, when he did look at his watch, it was, like, almost quarter of noon. And that's not necessarily the zenith of depending on where you are and what season. And but just saying, that's obviously easy.
If your iPhone can tell you when, like, the sunset is and and all that, I'm sure the ship can, right?
exactly, yeah.
But this is a tough scene between Clark and Chloe because he's shoving her off yet again, and she just blows up at him. She's like, look, Clark, I know you guys are together. You guys lied to my face. I'm a grown-up. I can deal with the fact that you guys are together, but you guys didn't trust me, and we just talked about this, and I came over here to warn you about something, but forget that. You know, so now she's not even going to tell him about Lionel looking into his life, and she just storms off. She's like, have a nice life, Clark, and I think in another situation, he might have tried to talk to him more, but, I mean, he's got bigger fish to fry here, right?
Yeah, again, just, like, communication would have saved this whole situation. Just been like, listen, give me 10 minutes, and then we'll talk all day long.
A conversation like that takes a while, and I know Clark had a lot to worry about, but still, man, respect your friends. You only have, like, 4 friends. Respect them all, please, equally. But we go to the church, and Helen's walking in, and she's happy, and Lex is happy, and the wedding is taking place. And as you said, we get that shot of Lana just looking kind of like she's holding back tears because, I mean, Clark's not there. I mean, I don't know, Lana. This isn't about you.
Right.
Lana, it's about them.
Yeah.
But, finally, Clark has gone down the storm cellar here. We have some intense music. You know, it's the drama gets revved up here, and I do like this. He's kind of like psyching himself up to open up the key because he knows, like, this is like pure kryptonite. This is not like a little fleck in a meteor rock as we've seen otherwise. This is like distilled pure kryptonite, so he knows that, like, this is gonna be tough for me to do, and I like how he just breaks open the case. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
huh?
I did too. It's a really good shot. And then grabs it and obviously sticks it in the ship, and like the kind of vein effect that they have when he gets exposed to kryptonite is super pronounced here, so obviously it's a little more painful.
Right,
than
I
normal.
Mean, it used to be the ripples, maybe a little bit of green, but now it's like, it is legit, like, there's like ivy growing on his hand. It's so insane. This was his plan all along. He's executed it now, and as you said, like, once he puts it in, it has this, like, really, like, gross looking, like, super rust. I think that was a good way to put it. And and it's kind of makes you look, ugh. Like, it looks kind of gross, and the ship is clearly trying to, like, just, like, it has a serious problem here. The ship is experiencing some issues.
Yeah, it explodes pretty big. So, and some big giant energy wave comes out of it because, well, naturally, of course, why not?
Well, unfortunately for the Kents, they are headed towards the Kent farm at this point. This energy wave comes out, and creates a Ken Trunk accident, and that's a plus one for a Ken Trunk accident, guys. And we see that truck roll over quite a few times.
It looked pretty bad. I do have to say, I have a problem with this scene because we see this energy wave, and we get this great big aerial shot. It goes over the farm and the house and all this, and it doesn't seem to affect anything else, like, at all. It just goes straight through everything. No windows are broken or trees go blown over. But, of course, the Kents are going at an unreasonable speed, and suddenly they lose control and flip the car 82,000 times. And I'm like, okay, I see why you did this, set this up. You could have made it maybe they got real close to the explosion or something else, but it just felt silly the way it was shown.
I know. I thought the same thing, too. But, they had to tie those two things together for Clark to feel extra guilt. But, yeah, and, you know, again, remember, guys, Martha was pregnant with a baby, and we'll see what happens to that. But we cut to Smallville Airport, I guess, and the Luther Corp jet is there, and Lex and Helen are all excited to get on the plane and start the rest of their lives together, and he gets a report from the pilot. There was an EMP, and then all the electronics are out throughout the area. So that's basically what that pulse was from the ship. But based off my knowledge of EMPs from movies like The Matrix, I don't think those create any kind of force, as you were saying, that would disturb anything, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, at worst, it wouldn't even, because a car is a mechanical, not electrical. But at worst, it would shut the car off, I guess. But it doesn't, I don't know, it's just like they lose control for no reason at all. So it's also a weird time for that shot to happen when they cut to Lex, because right before we see the truck accident, and then we get this scene with Lex. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know if this is at the same time yet or not, but if it is, that was a really fast wedding. Like, did they even have a reception or whatever? But it was fine. But then the next shot is going to be Clark seeing his parents hurt. And I'm like, when did this take place? Did they just run out of the church and run to the airport? I was a little confused about the timing for that one, but
right. Well, there is some insight in this conversation here. Matt Beck, one of the supervisors on the show, was talking about the explosion. He says originally it was going to be a huge explosion, but the problem was that nobody wanted to destroy the farm and build it up again. So it was determined that it was more like an electromagnetic pulse. So that is like the leftover from the initial conception, you know, like if it was truly a real explosion, then that would have done something to the truck as opposed to, you know,
right. Right.
Nothing. But yeah, I did like how the ground kind of imploded first. And then they played. It kind of reminded me of, I've been dogging on Superman Returns so much, but like Superman Returns where like the red sun of Krypton explodes, like it goes in and then out.
Yeah.
That's just a cool little effect there. Now, then we cut to, Clark realizing, you know, waking up from this explosion and seeing, you know, the truck that had been flipped over. And I thought this was very impressive, like this set. I mean, obviously they dug a hole outside.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah, and it looked like the thing exploded. I mean, it looked like that's exactly what happened.
Now that looked like an explosion. That didn't look like an EMP to me.
No way. Yeah,
but then Greg Beeman, the director, he noted that the art department did a great job on that. Everyone laughs at me because whenever it's time for actors to be dirty or bloody, inevitably I think they come out of makeup looking 20% of what they need to be. So Tom Welling comes out and I say, "Hand me a bag of dirt," and I smear dirt on him. So yeah, that's definitely he really did look like he had been through an explosion, like a building had fallen on him.
Yep.
But then Clark speeds over to the truck, obviously takes his parents to the hospital. And then we get a plus one for a hospital visit. That's a plus one because Martha is now in the hospital yet again. And then we have this great scene between Clark and Jonathan here. And this is some raw emotion here from Jonathan. Usually the Kents are nothing but supportive and all that. But Jonathan, he's like, "What did you do, Clark?" He's like very upset with him. And he's like, "And now your mother is in a hospital bed." And this is raw stuff because Clark's not telling his parents. Again, lack of communication. He made some bad choices, and now everything has gone to hell for this family. But again, they go to the hospital all the time. So yeah. Is it really that much worse? Like, the drama behind it is not as extreme as it should be when we have, spoilers, we have almost 30 hospital visits so far over the course of this show. So
yeah, I thought it was a little dishonest. I didn't like the fact that Jonathan was so upset. He had no idea what had taken place. So, but it seems like he had automatically just started with blaming Clark, which is not like him, you know, not to get right. That angry. And like, obviously they're doing this so that they can push Clark away. If they had told him, like, for example, that if Clark had just revealed to him what he had done with the key and everything, and he had already known about the baby, then I can kind of see that making him really upset. But this was before he even knew about that. So I don't, it seems weird to me that he's so upset, but.
That's a good point. You know, I guess they wanted that final moment where the, you know, the doctor comes out and says, Martha's going to be, she had a mild concussion, but she'll be okay. And Jonathan says, what about our baby? Jesus says, I'm sorry. And walks off. It's like, what?
Yeah. Thanks for the info, Doc.
I knew what you were, I understand what they were trying to go for there. Like, they didn't want to, like, bog down this emotional scene with, like, information, but it's like, could we get a little more analysis on that, please, doctor? Like,
yeah.
But then, I mean, I think, valid points all, Daniel, but I do think when, you know, after they get that news, Jonathan just slams the door in Clark's face at the hospital. I'm like, that's powerful stuff, because they've always been the strong family unit, and they're finally broken up in that way.
It still does, like, it does feel, even after, it does feel forced to me a little bit, only because, like you said, they're always so strong. I mean, I understand the extra motivation here, I get it, but it just seems like he doesn't even know all the facts. It's not like Clark did it on purpose, you know, and I know he's going to be emotional, and he's may lose his temper, as we see from time to time. It's just, I don't know, it's just, it feels really, really forced, like they're actually actively trying to push Clark away, which they were, obviously. But
yeah, I mean there's some episodes that, like, all the drama comes organic from the characters, and others where, like, it has to be a little more manufactured, people have to act a little out of character, and I know, I totally get what you're saying there about Jonathan. But meanwhile, Lex, other than Clark and the kids not being at his wedding, his life seems to be pretty good. He comes into the lounge area of the plane, and him and Helen share a drink, and, you know, you can read a lot into, like, I guess Helen's facial expression or lack thereof. I don't know. Like, I'm just, in retrospect, you're trying to, like, see if there are any hints that they knew what they were doing with these characters, and I just don't know, because they cheers, and they both take a sip of their drink, and as far as we know, they're off their honeymoon, huh?
Yeah, well, we would think so, but yeah, no, she doesn't act like a normal person would be acting. She's acting all dodgy and cagey, and it's...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think, I don't know if that's us just trying to make sense of what happens next or what. Like, maybe just on the surface it's normal, but I don't know. Lex is just really happy, so enjoy it while it lasts, Lex. It's not going to last very long. So then we come back to the kid farm. Clark is in this crater. No one has come to investigate this giant explosion, yep. But Lana, I guess. A little odd. But, you know, I think Tom Welling did a really good job in this scene, like, acting completely overwhelmed. Like, he just looks really just, like, well, overwhelmed with everything. And Gray Beeman in The Companion, he says... The scene with Clark and Lana was very unusual. I took Tom aside and I told him about the place of despair that he had to get to. I talked to him like a coach and then staged the scene and rolled camera. And he did it. It was awesome. I knew he was never going to perform it this good again. You thought he was shell-shocked and dazed. I did one take and said, cut, print, checked there were no technical problems, and went to move on. Tom was amazed, but I told him he would never do it that good again. He channeled the emotion I wanted. So, I agree. I mean, I think he does really good in this scene, and this is actually a good scene between Clark and Lana. And Clark even mentions, like, his mom lost the baby, and she's like, the baby? Because they hadn't told anyone about the baby. They've been keeping it a secret because the kids had been barren before. They didn't want to jinx it, you know, as silly as that sounds.
He did very well, and he looked panicked. And obviously, hearing that news would definitely really impact you. And obviously, you know, this everything that's happened in these past few days or whatever is really... come to a head, and yeah, he doesn't know how to handle the situation.
I don't know. I mean, it's tough because obviously him and Chloe's relationship is messed up now. Lex is gone. His parents are, you know, well, you know, have slammed the door in his face, and he just kind of pushes Lana away, and I don't know if that's, like, the smartest thing to do, but I don't know. You got somebody there, like, going through all this crap. Somebody there is like, hey, let me help you. Like, just tell her, Clark. I mean, what's the worst that could happen at this point, right?
Yeah, I think he's just clearly... just impacted by it. Like, he's overwhelmed in that moment, I think, is what's happening. And I think he would have cooled down and probably been able to talk to her later if he didn't go off and do something stupid. But of course, that's not what's going to happen. So,
right. And, you know, we got 8 more seasons of the show, so we can't be...
Yeah, that's true. We can't resolve everything right away.
Clark goes to the torch looking for the red kryptonite ring. What'd you think about this?
Dumb. I mean, I get it. Again, I get why, like you just mentioned, sometimes the drama has to come, it's in a little more manufactured state. And this is exactly that. It's never shown. I mean, he states that it makes me feel good. And I can understand, like, okay, so now we have this, all this motivation, all this guilt that he feels. And of course, he's going to want to feel good, but he should know better than to do this. And it didn't turn out very well for him last time he was using it. So, but I get it. It's like a drug metaphor, right? He needs something to help right now, and he doesn't know what else he can do. And he's like, but his main complaint is that he hurts everybody that he cares about. And
what do you think this is going
to
do?
Yeah, this is not going to help your situation, Clark. I hate to tell you.
Kenneth Biller said this in The Companion, that's the place where we pay off Red Kryptonite. Now we really see him go, quote, on drugs to solve his own pain and his guilt about what he's done. We successfully set up a bunch of different cliffhangers here, and it really just rocks and rolls. So, they were proud of that. I have not liked the idea of Red Kryptonite as a drug or all that. I mean, they talked about that in The Companion when they were talking about Red. Like, oh, yeah, well, what would, you know, kids on drugs. I'm like, no, that's, I don't like that metaphor, especially Superman choosing to do it. Yeah. Right? I know he's young Superman, but he still wouldn't choose to expose himself to that. Pete Ross, the voice of reason. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've been very impressed with Pete in season two, you know, because people laugh him off of his character, and he is played for comic relief, but he's there to kind of tell Clark, like, hey, man, when you put that ring on, you're not yourself. He's like, that's exactly who I don't want to be right now, Pete. You know, he finds, like, the last red kryptonite ring at the torch. So, of course, Chloe would keep one, you know. But we have a plus one for our amazing technicolor kryptonite because it's our another instance of seeing kryptonite that is not green.
There's a problem with how it's handled, too. He has it. He picks it up, puts it in his pocket, and it never affects him until he actually puts the ring on his finger.
Must be a lead box, Dan.
It was not a lead box. That was a standard ring box.
No, I thought the same. They're treating it like the Ring of Power, right? From Lord of the Rings. Like, no. You can't just wear it on a necklace, which, okay, hello, Clark does that later in the show. Right? He has a red kryptonite necklace. There's other forms that he takes, and it's just the proximity of it. The ring was smart because it makes it stay in proximity to him without his knowledge. That's why I thought Red was so smart about that. But him just having it in his pocket does not track. You're absolutely right. But then meanwhile, Lionel and Chloe are having a heart-to-heart. Chloe has just said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to accept Lionel's offer anyway. They have a great conversation here, a great scene between them. But, you know, was it just me, or did they kind of overdo the goth Chloe in this scene?
Oh, my goodness. It's like she decides to become evil Chloe between the last scene we saw her in and this scene. And it's so silly. It's why couldn't she just be her normal self, like realize that she's not doing the best thing ever, but but right now she's hurt. She doesn't care if she hurts Clark, but still be herself. You know what I mean? Like, still, she never wears black. So what is this about? Like, it's so silly. It's so jarring. It's like, okay, just like
she stopped at Hot Topic on the way to leave.
Exactly. cleaned house, I guess.
Yeah, but Lionel has a great bit of dialogue here. He says, you know, love has a way of blinding even the sharpest minds. We don't look because we don't want to see. But once that love has been stripped away, then we see the real person clearly. They reveal to us with all their flaws, their foibles, and their secrets. I mean, I thought that was a great bit of Luther insight there. And just, I mean, that's, you know, they're good students of humanity, I think. And that's a very good bit of dialogue from Lionel to her. And then after he delivers this great dialogue, he's like, oh, well, I have a meeting. Let me show you out.
Yep.
It's just kind of interesting.
I told you my evil, you know, evil psychology, and now you have to go.
Yeah, and she does ask him, like, why are you so interested in Clark? He's like, oh, well, I'm not going to tell you that yet, am I? So so she would ask. This promises, like, an evil Chloe the next season. But we don't really pay off on that promise so much. So, but an interesting place to take the character nonetheless. So he kind of ushers her out. And then he pulls out that envelope that him and Helen had been handing back and forth. And I still don't know what that's all about.
What does that even suggest? I really don't even know what it's supposed to imply, because he insinuated that it was a gift for them, for a wedding, and she gave it back. I guess I'm not really sure. But then if we take the Helen is evil thing to that conclusion, she should have taken the envelope, but she didn't.
Well, I'm thinking real, in what really happened was she was giving that to him, but in order to cover when Lex saw him out there.
But what would she give to him?
That's a good question.
even if she was evil, she should only be taking from him, right? There would not be anything that she needed to give him. It's so bizarre because this scene, it makes these weird implications, and never clarifies, or you'll never ever know what the heck was in that envelope.
That's true, because they don't ever really follow up on that. And we know that the blood wouldn't fit in there.
Exactly. It's just
I know people are like, oh, is the blood? Oh my God, it's an envelope. It's a two-dimensional.
I don't know. It's so weird. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, it was an odd. It was an odd choice. But you're right. What? They act like there's so much importance to it.
And then we never ever find out. So.
Well, then here we go, man. This is the last scene here. Clark is on the farm, and he's getting ready. He's rolled out Jonathan's old motorcycle to go in full Red Kryptonite mode. It's weird because when he did that in the past, like, he was already on the Red Kryptonite under its influence for a while, so he would, you know, gravitate towards those things after a while. But this is like, he's like methodically thinking it out. He's okay, I'm gonna put this ring on. I know I'm gonna want my leather jacket. I know I'm gonna want my sunglasses. I know I'm gonna want my motorcycle. Like, it's very thought out, which doesn't track with Clark and Superman. I mean, I know this is a really dark place for him, but I still wouldn't see him intentionally putting on this Red Kryptonite ring and running away from his problem.
It's so silly too, because I think it's like their way of, oh, he's a bad boy now. He's, you know, he doesn't wear blue or red, and he's gonna wear his black leather jacket and sunglasses. And it's like, it's such a shallow way to show this kind of stuff. It's so silly to me, but yeah, he gets back out on the hog, and because only, you know, bad people ride on motorcycles.
That is true. That is quite a negative connotation they put towards motorcycles. They drop the L-bomb on each other. You know, like, oh, I love you. It's like, I love you too. It's like, now I'm really going to leave town. Right? Dropping the L-bomb.
Yeah, awkward. I love you too. I'm going to go run away now. Bye.
Right. And this is great trailer dialogue here. He's like, the Clark Kent you know is a lie. Like, I totally feel like they write these lines where they can take him out of context in the trailer. It's interesting because, you know, he tells her, like, yeah, I love you. That's why I have to go. I don't want to hurt you. I hurt everyone around me. So that's his stance, right? But then he puts on the Red Kryptonite ring, which, again, we've already discussed the physics and logic or whatever of that are incorrect. And then we have a plus one for under the influence, because now Clark's under the influence of Red Kryptonite. But then he immediately changes gears, and he tells Lana, come with me, you know? And she's like, no, everything I love is here. I'm like, is it? Really? Because, you know, your aunt left, your biological father is out of your life now, like, Clark's leaving, like, why don't you go with him, you know? She doesn't. She's crying. He drives off. And then we cut to Lex, and he's waking up. He awakens to the plane being complete disarray. Everyone is gone. The oxygen masks have dropped. He goes up to the cockpit. The last thing you want to see if you wake up in an airplane is the empty cockpit.
With, like, the panels all destroyed and stuff, too.
Yeah, like, what happened here, right? He looks out the window, and they're going towards water fast, and the plane crashes. And then that he spends 5 years in hell returning home with one goal, to save his city. No, it's quite a cliffhanger, though, isn't it?
Yeah, here's the thing. I am not a physicist, but I imagine that if you're in a plane that is in free fall, directly at the ocean, like, straight down, I'm pretty sure he'd be dead. I don't think it's not even like he jumped in the cockpit and, like, tried to save the landing and then the crash, and then, you know, it's just like straight into the ocean.
He didn't try to do the golden eye thing where he comes up from the nosedive.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's okay. It's dramatic, so I get it. And it's fine because it's not really fine because we'll see what happens next season. But
right. And then we cut to our last shot of the season with our Clark's being bad to the bone out there on his motorcycle. And he hears Jor-El in his head one last time. He's like, you will obey me, Kal-El, which shows that it wasn't necessarily the ship. It was... I don't know what it was then. If it wasn't the ship, like, is it in his head? Is it like the cave transmitting towards him? Is he just remembering that? Right? Who knows? But as Goff mentioned earlier, and when he was talking about Exodus, like, was this all part of Jor-El's plan? Because he disobeyed, and then all his family suffered, just like Jor-El said. I mean, Clark even says, he's like, he was right. He told me this would happen. And not so many words, Clark, but maybe.
No, not so many words.
But then we pan up to what we assume is Metropolis ahead of him on the road there. It's a lot further away than it was back in season one in Nicodemus when they saw from that windmill. And that's the end of season two. Interesting to note, no to be continued here.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was one in the last episode.
I wonder if it's because, not that this is a huge difference, but there is a 3-month break, right, between this and the next episode. So maybe it's like, because it's not directly after, that's why. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was, I was surprised because there was a two-week continuum between Calling and Exodus, although it immediately picked up after the point. And as I pointed out on our social media a while ago, I was interested to see that at the end of Tempest, because I went back and checked, they must have lost the to-be continued card because it's a completely different font.
Oh, interesting.
It was, yeah. And they find it again later on, because I know in other episodes they do it correctly. I believe even in Exile they do it. But to be continued, they find the correct font. So it's like something they like had an intern go do and he didn't double check or something at the last minute. But yeah, unlike season one where it picks up, where season two picks up immediately after it, season three picks up 3 months later. So I see your point there. And that's my justification as well, Dan. But that is Exodus. Also, they're playing the John Williams music here, something we didn't mention. I love how they use the John Williams score mm-hmm. throughout this episode. I wish they would have used it more throughout Smallville. Season 2 is the only time they use it that Mark Snow reorchestrated it. And they bring it back for the series finale, but it's just, you know, the John Williams track from Superman the movie. It's not reorchestrating it. I guess, I don't know, I guess they felt like they didn't want to overdo it. Maybe that's why they stopped, but I thought that was great. It really added a lot of just nostalgia factor and coolness and nerd cred
yeah, to all the scenes. Yeah, it's great whenever it shows up, yeah, for sure.
But that's how the season is. It's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Clark, what happened? Looks like a bomb went off. Where are your parents?
Hospital. They're fine. My mom lost the baby.
The baby?
This is all my fault, Lana. I did this.
How could you do this?
Same way I always do. Bring pain and suffering to everyone's lives.
Clark, that's not true.
Yes, Lana, it is. Lana, I've kept so much from you. If you knew the truth, you'd never talk to me again.
I don't believe that.
I tried to cover up my past and push it away. I couldn't. He said if I didn't go, everyone I love would be hurt. He was right.
Clark, you're in shock. You don't
No, Lana, stay away from me. Stay away from me before I hurt you too.
Exodus got a 9.2 out of 10 on IMDb. Now that is according to Graph TV, the website that you can, you know, put in any TV show and see how they all rank on IMDb. That is one of the top 10 episodes of Smallville according to IMDb. Yeah, it's I thought that was interesting. And Superman homepage, Neil Bailey, gave it a 5 out of 5. So high scores all around for these guys. Daniel, what would you give Exodus, you know, on our A plus to F scale here we do on Always Hold On to Smallville?
I would not put it anywhere close to the top 10. That's for sure. I don't really love this episode. I don't like where it ends up with the Red Kryptonite running away to Metropolis. I don't like where it puts Lex. I mean, that's next season's problem, but this episode puts him there. So I don't know. Nothing good comes out of what's going on in this episode. And there's a lot of problems I have, obviously, within the episode itself. I don't know. I guess it's probably one of my least favorite final episodes of any season. I guess I'll be generous. I'll give it a C because it's
C.
Yeah.
See, man, you are always so rough on these episodes.
It's A. C is average. I mean, it's just, I don't know. This episode taken on its own, even disregarding what happens in the future, I don't know. It's just too wonky with what's going on with the technology, what's going on with the character motivations, what is happening, the drama. It's a bit too much for me. So yeah, I would say average is generous for me.
All right, that's fair enough. So C for you. I'm gonna go ahead and say a B+. I mean, in retrospect, I was thinking, oh yeah, Exodus and Calling, these are great. No, I gave Calling an A+ last week because I love that episode. I feel like that's the superior of these two for sure. But talking through it with you here, it's like, yeah, like, it slowly dropped back down to, you know, I know it's higher than the one you gave it, but still, B+, for a Smallville finale, that's pretty low, because usually they knock it out of the park with these finales.
They do,
so,
yeah.
I think all the execution is pretty good, but it's just the direction they chose to take the story is more the problem I have with it. Clark running away and things of that nature. And again, the lack of communication. Whenever these issues can be solved by, like, as you said, just characters sitting down in a room and talking for 5 minutes.
Or texting each other.
Yeah, a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, hey, this is 2003, so...
Hey, I had a cell phone in 2003. Yet. There's no reason why Superman couldn't have a cell phone.
It's Smallville. They're on a budget, okay? You know, all these guys, they live in a small town. Maybe Lex could text, but nobody else. But So a C for you and a B+ for me. So our last order of business, Dan, is the series tally board. Now, we have quite a few tally boards to discuss on this episode. First of all, I was surprised that he did not wear the red jacket and the blue shirt. I thought that was, like, at this point, I thought it was standard Smallville procedure for him to do so. In every important episode, he did not. So that's a non-tally board. But for categories we did get, we got a +1 to Amazing Technicolor Kryptonite, because we saw Red Kryptonite for the third time. So that's 3 so far in the series. We have a +1 for a hospital visit, which is 29. So we've gone through 2 seasons of this show, Daniel. 29 visits to the hospital.
that
kind of undercuts Jonathan's, like, your mother is in a hospital bed. I'm like, yeah, Dad, she was in one like a month ago too, and she's fine. Okay.
You know, the kids are broke, I think, because of their health insurance.
Yeah, and their car insurance, right?
Yeah,
because the other one would be a Kent truck accident, which is +1. That's 7. So we have 7 Kent truck accidents so far. And I got a shout out to my friend Lance Lasser. He predicted there'd be 50 throughout the course of the show. I think he was a little overzealous there. But we have 7 so far through 2 seasons. And then we have a +1 for Under the Influence, because Clark is on Red Kryptonite. So that's 12. And then finally, we have a +1 for weddings, which brings us to 2, both of which have been Lex Luthor's wedding so far, because he got married twice in season 2, back in Heat.
That's right. In
this episode. Wait a second. Time out, Dan. Were you on Heat?
I was just going to say that. I'm like, wait a minute. I was on. Because I'm like, we talked about that. Yeah.
That's funny. You know, I'm like, should I edit that out? No, we completely forgot.
Yeah.
That you were on. That is great. This is live, guys. This is raw. Always on a Smallville, unplugged, unedited. So we just realized that we have talked since.
That's right.
Obscura.
That's right.
That's funny, man. I can't believe we both forgot that. But that just, yeah. So you talked about both Alexis weddings. There's what the tie in there is. I like having these tie ins with guests. You know, like, oh, like Nancy did our Home Improvement 2-pack this season with the two guys from Home Improvement Kids. So you're our Lex weddings.
Awesome.
Great. Season 2. I can't believe we both forgot that. That's great. Hopefully, you listeners will appreciate that revelation.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know how I forgot that. Yeah. That's funny.
What did I say? Us nerds have better retention than most people. Maybe not.
Selective, I guess, maybe.
Selective. And then finally, the Bechdel test. I believe this episode fails, unfortunately.
Yes, it does, because they talk about Clark in that whole scene, huh?
Right. Yep.
Yep.
There you have it, guys. So season 2, thanks for listening to us so far. It's been a lot of fun going through 2 seasons of Smallville, and we have 8 more to go. So, Dan, if people want to find you on the internet, and perhaps your previous appearances on Always Alone in Smallville, if they forget.
Yeah, right.
where can they find you out there, man?
I have a couple of podcasts you can listen to. If you wanted just some general Star Trek chat, you can find me over on the Nerd Party at SETI Alpha 3. I also have an Xbox podcast. So if you want to listen to that, you can find us. It's called Zed to Zed. If you want to contact me specifically and maybe argue that I was really mean to this episode, which I don't think I was, you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is 1UpDan. That is the number 1, not the word.
All right. As for me personally, you can find me at MoronZach on Twitter. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of another podcast, Standard Orbit, on the Trek FM network. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM or on Facebook at Trek FM. I'm on the Standard Orbit podcast, where we talk about the new and old adventures of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise, old Star Trek, animated Star Trek movies, old and new. So we're talking about all kinds of stuff over there at Trek FM. And as for this podcast, you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with 1S. You can send us an email at alwaysmallville@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook at Always Hold On to Smallville. See, I usually read those in a different order, but hey, that's just the way it came out in my head today. So email them, Facebook. So yeah, guys, so we're not going to go on some massive exodus. See what I did there? Mixed it in. Because they didn't end the episode. That's another thing. Nobody said Exodus. I was not surprised to find that, Dan. No one said Exodus in this episode. But so I know last season, you know, I took a huge break about 3 months. I'm not going to do that. We'll be back sooner than that this time. And, you know, I've been going on these random breaks every now and then. I think that's maybe the way I want to do it moving forward, just to, you know, give you guys a peek behind the curtain. I don't want to go for so long without doing a podcast. But at the same time, I do have real life I'm trying to live here. So... gets in the way of podcasting sometimes. It's inconvenient.
It's crazy,
huh? Yeah, so, you know, I'll probably just keep trucking along. Maybe, you know, every now and then take a 2 or 3 week break and then keep trucking along, much like Smallville did back in the day, yeah. You know, with his winter hiatuses and stuff like that. So yeah, we're not running off the Metropolis for 3 months, guys. Don't worry. We'll be back. But yeah, so it's we're in it for the long haul here. 8 more seasons. Can't wait. But yeah, until then, I'm not sure what the next episode will be. We might have a mailbag. We might have a Supergirl review of season 2 of that show. We'll probably have something else before we come back for Exile, but until then, always hold on to Smallville.